This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirectguide.com.
At the dawn of the day, all the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses.
Welcome, welcome. Welcome to Bread and Roses, Feminist News and Public Affairs. I'm your host, Della Ray, and our engineer this evening is Lee Ann Kranz. Our collective brings you this show every Friday night at 6 p.m. Women have had this forum on KBOO for 35 years. This airspace is here to be shared. This collective is open to new members. If you are a woman in body or spirit, we will help train and support you. If you are interested, please contact KBOO's volunteer coordinator, Ani Haynes. You can also find us on KBOO's website at KBOOFM/Bread and Roses or on Facebook at KBOO Bread Roses Women's News. This evening, we are discussing practical application of self-care. But before we go on with that, there's something I want to share with you. Here's what I believe. I believe that in order to do well, we must first be well. I believe that taking the very best care of ourselves links to better everything. I advocate this message as an author and a host of this show on Bread and Roses. So let's get down to why we're here. I mentioned the topic for the show about practical application of self-care. Joining us in the studio is Marie Daniels. Marie is a committed person, to say the least. She's committed to social, economic, and environmental justice. She has worked as a trainer in corporate America, as well as an instructor for college students, high-risk youth, and now incarcerated women. Welcome to the show, Marie.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So go ahead, tell us a little bit about you and how you got to where you are now.
Well, it has been a completely random journey.
Yeah.
I spent most of my youth in a military family until I was 18. A lot of people, they're parent that's in the military is out of the military early, but I spent all of my first 18 years in the military with my father. We moved around a great deal, but I spent most of my life in the South, in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia. And about 10 years ago, well, longer than that, I had some upheaval in my personal life. I decided to go back to school, get my undergraduate degree, which I did, and then was looking around, and a friend of mine moved across the country to go to law school, and I was like, whoa, if she can do that, I can do that. So I decided to look around for a school that had a degree in conflict resolution, and Portland State was the place that I came to that I just immediately felt at home. So I decided to do that. And so in 2004, I moved out here to get my degree, my master's degree. I ended up creating a master's program for myself in the guise of a master's of teaching, but I got a master's in peace education and a lot of background in, issues and problems in the world, in where conflict and education intersect, and finished that, completed my degree, and then went to work at Portland Youth Builders, which is a local alternative high school for young people who have just really struggled in more traditional schooling environments. And so I was there for about 2.5 years. And learned a great deal about working with that population. And during the course of time that I had been here in Portland, had seen myself, my beliefs, my ideas, my approach to the world, even my personality just radically change, probably as a result of education. I finally got some really intensive education that was a lot broader than anything I had had before. And so I think that was really, really helpful for me in learning more about how to be a good citizen in the world and what are the responsibilities of people who are, you know, given more opportunities and more chances just, you know, by birth, by who they are, where they're born, how they live and whatnot. And so the next few years after I left Youth Builders, I spent, as many of us did during the, you know, first few years of the recession, really struggling and finding a variety of things to do to keep myself moving forward. And in late 2011, I was fortunate enough to be hired to run a computer training program down at Coffee Creek in the women's prison. And that has been quite an experience. I've been there 2.5 years now, and it's been a very profound experience in many ways. And
okay, can I back you up and ask you about your takeaways from working with at-risk youth?
Sure. So when I went to work at Youth Builders, I started working in my background in history is that I spent 25 years in the business world before I went back to school and around and during that time. So I had worked as a documentation and trainer, a technical trainer. So I had done all kinds of different training software applications and things like that. And so they hired me to come in and be part of their computer training program. And it was working with young people who had faced and continue to face on a daily basis, continued developing my ideas around working with people who face significant challenges. And part of the reason that my outlook on life had changed so dramatically is I had gotten a job again as a computer trainer with a small, but this is during the welfare to work years. I had started working with a small consulting agency that helped transition people off of welfare. Mm-hmm. And so what I saw in working there was completely antithetical to everything that I had believed about people who were lazy and didn't want to work and all this stuff. And I saw for myself firsthand that those things are not true and that people have all these barriers. And so working with young people at Youth Builders gave me an even deeper look at not only the barriers that adults face, but how those barriers impact young people, and then how those cycles are often perpetuated on from generation to generation.
Give us an example.
Well, I mean, probably the most clear example is, you know, abusive households. Mm-hmm. So how abuse perpetuates. It doesn't always perpetuate, but when you have a household where, you know, someone in the family has been abused, people who have been abused are much more likely to turn around and abuse someone else, whether it's a spouse or a child or a niece or nephew or whatever. And then those people in turn may turn around and abuse others when they get older. They don't always do it when they're younger, but when they get older, you know, their coping skills, the way that they develop handling stress, the way that they learn how to deal with conflict, how they manage difficulties in relationships, those skills are very underdeveloped. And that in turn can perpetuate abusive behavior, but also really dysfunctional interpersonal behavior, not just physical, but emotional and communication, things like that. And definitely saw that working with these young folks. You get, you know, a 17-year-old who's going to school and trying to work and trying to take care of two small children because, you know, their parents are not around for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And you learn really quickly that you have to be really cognizant of that, and you can't just pretend it doesn't exist.
Yes, for sure. So I want to bring you forward now to working at Coffee Creek. Tell us more about that and how your experience with the youth ties into your experience today.
Well, I would say that there are two sort of grim ways that those things are connected. Mm-hmm. And one is that those young people very likely would go on to be people who are incarcerated, at least some portion of them. Some of them were already there through the Oregon Youth Association, so they're already adjudicated youth. And then some of them are the children of the women who are the women and the men at other prisons who are incarcerated. And so they're struggling to not only try to live their own lives and do all the things society expects of them, they're struggling with having an incarcerated parent, or in some cases having two incarcerated parents. And so maybe they're living with a grandparent, maybe they're living with a family friend, maybe they're living by themselves and couch surfing around. Maybe they're having to take care of younger siblings or, you know, other little family members, taking care of an elderly grandparent who's sick and that they have to, you know, it's their responsibility because they live there to take care of that grandparent.
You have said so much just now. I have to say, I'm not even sure which direction to take this in, Marie. I mean, seriously, I'm sure a lot of people have a lot of questions, but I want to go in this direction with asking you more about your class, what you teach, and tying that back to the practical application of self-care and how you view it.
Right. So the class that I teach is it's a work-based education program. The state of Oregon has seven, or is mandated by the legislature. Department of Corrections runs a minimum of seven programs, which we have three at Coffee Creek for the women, which is outstanding and is a small step toward addressing some of the inequities between, you know, men and women as they come out of prison. Like, women are far more likely to not be able to find jobs that they can use to help support themselves and their children. So having these programs there, I think, is a good way to try to address some of that inequity. And my program is a computer training program. Okay. Of the three programs, it is the one program that does not result in students having a specific vocational certification or vocational path clearly laid out. One of our programs is hair design. So when they leave, they're certified. They have 2,000 hours of work. They have passed all their boards. They're certified. And that's a pretty clear career path. And our other program is an eyeglass recycling program. It's a huge program, and they do all the glasses for inmates all over the state, work with the Lions. Great program. And they come out with a, I think, dispensing opticians licensure. Okay. So also vocation. So mine, students go through and learn all of the Microsoft applications. Mm-hmm. And they have the opportunity to test for Microsoft Office specialization certificates. Okay. And those things are fantastic, and they're great confidence builders for students. And they do demonstrate that they have a certain level of knowledge. Mm-hmm. But as we all know, knowing computers is a basic work skill. It's not training for a specific vocation. So what I try to do is include a huge chunk of personal development. Well, not what I try to do. What I do in addition to computer training is include an enormous chunk of personal development work. Okay. So we use the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People as a structure, as a method or of training and development. And we really focus on what are the habits that people have developed some of them that have brought them there. And then what are some of the things that we can do to help them while they're in my class to learn different things.
Okay. Let me back you up. This is a computer class. You're bringing in personal application because you realize the importance of it serving your students. How?
Well, it's really, how do they get a job? Mm-hmm. How do you get a job? How do you keep a job?
If you
don't know how to behave, if you don't know how to talk to people, if you don't know any of those things, then it's really difficult to sell yourself to an employer in the first place if you aren't able to really think about yourself in any sort of positive way. Mm-hmm. And that all comes back. You know, there's so many layers to this. It's right. Difficult to know, what do you talk about?
Sure.
You know, how do you talk about that? So since it's a work-based education program, we really emphasize employability skills. You know, what can we do to help you be more employable? Well, those skills are usually just basic life skills.
Right.
And so we work a lot on those in the context of this is how you operate in a work environment. And of course, that bleeds over into how do you operate in your personal life.
Thank you. Tell us more about that. Tell us more about how you make the connection with your students about, yes, you have a job or you're getting a job, but if you are feeling, if your self-esteem is lacking, or if you're not feeling great about yourself, how are you going to sit in the chair and reach over and shake the hand of the person that has a potential job for you?
Well, I think talking about an interview is a pretty easy entree into that, because mm-hmm. we know the job market is really tight. We know that people who have records are often just not given the chance even to interview. A lot of times if it, you know, you have on the application, do you have a felony? If that box is checked yes, then, you know, there's a possibility that you're not even going to make an interview. So it means that if you do get an interview, you have to be even more on your game. And so a lot of what we talk about is how do you think about yourself differently? Mm-hmm. We do an exercise where they write a felony explanation letter, which they don't give to anyone, mm-hmm. but the exercise, the writing of it, where you focus on, yes, I made mistakes, mm-hmm. and here is what I've done to change, and here's where I'm going. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that are really important. We had a presenter in the class this last week, and we talked about felony explanation letters very briefly. And I had several people who were visitors from other programs were like, oh, I thought I had to tell everybody everything. Mm-hmm. I thought if I went in and did an interview, I had to tell them all the details of, you know, my crime, or if I'm in recovery, I have to tell them all this stuff about being an addict. And no, mm-hmm. you don't have to do that. But you have to have the confidence to be able to walk in and sit down and say, this is who I am. I have made mistakes in my life. I have paid the price that society tells me I have to pay for that. Here's how I took advantage of my time. I didn't just sit around, you know, causing problems or whatever, or just laying around reading romance novels. But I really worked, and now this is where I am, and this is where I want to go. And that takes a really strong base and sense of yourself and confidence in yourself.
Tell us how long you spend with your students weekly. How long are they in your class? How much contact do you have with your students?
I spend an enormous amount of time with them. This particular class has been a little bit longer because it's the first time running the curriculum, and it just takes more. Anybody out there who's an educator knows that developing curriculum as you teach is just a lengthy process. So this class I've had for 18 months, and I have them 24 to 25 hours a week. Mm-hmm. I have 16 women. I have 13 now, but my class is usually 16 people, and I'm with them that amount of time. I'm not always physically right in front of their faces, but my office is right next to my classroom, and I'm always available for them. So I do spend a lot of time with them.
Okay. Well, I think that we've done a really good job sharing with our listeners who you are and what your schedule and what you do and how much time you spend with the students and what your program is like. I do want to go to break, and when we come back, I'm going to start really peeling back the layers and talk about the actual practical application. Thank you for being here. You are listening to KBOO Bread and Roses. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
We don't know why we're fighting or who's winning. They're keeping us distracted with the game. And all the time a storm of woe is spinning, headed our direction as we blame. Oh, and you would think they tell us where we're going, and you would think they'd help us to prepare. 'Cause we'd all make amends if we knew this was the end. Well, keeping it a secret just ain't fair. Oh no, keeping it a secret just ain't fair. And every year the summer's getting hotter, earthquakes and tsunamis are the norm. And where will we all go when those reactors start to blow? And how could we escape a solar storm? Oh, and you would think the government would tell us. You would think they'd want to let us know. 'Cause we'd start loving right if we knew.
We're back. You are listening to Bread and Roses on KBOO. I'm your host, Della Ray. I just played Walk Away by local artist Belinda Underwood. I love local music, and I love to play local musicians. So if you're out there and you want to get your music played, let me hear from you. Joining us in the studio is Marie Daniels. She is committed to social, economic, and environmental justice. She has worked as a trainer in corporate America, as well as an instructor for college students, high-risk youth, and now incarcerated women. We are discussing practical application of self-care. When we left for break, we were talking about, just setting up really what her class is about and how much time she has with the women. But now I really want to go deeper about what self-care and practical applications. And I love when we were getting ready for this interview, you gave me this really great visual to think about. And it's, you were just talking about how we all have all these things going on. But on the basic bottom level line, there's food and shelter and tribe. And to think of this as almost like a food pyramid. So I'm going to let you take over, and I'm sure you'll do a better job explaining it.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but I do think we talk a lot about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, mm-hmm. and the bottom is your basic human needs, and the very top of the pyramid is human, self-actualization, and then there are various, probably I think four levels in between those two, and they encompass all of the other things that humans need to be become fully self-aware, fully actualized, to reach our potential, however you want to state that. But it all really comes down to having a really solid foundation of feeling that you are safe in the world and that your basic human needs are going to get met. So food, shelter, safety from physical harm, and then all that graduates up into needing love, needing acceptance, needing to be heard, all of these other things that, we all desire strongly as human beings. So with that in mind, if you think about it in terms of people developing in that way, it becomes really clear that expecting someone who lives in extreme poverty, who's born into a family that's all about crime and illegal activity and always worried about getting caught, or families where people are introducing their children to drugs at 7 and 8 years old, and you have these extremely dysfunctional, chaotic, and kind of violent environments, it's difficult for people to feel safe. And so all of these other areas of our development as humans that are predicated on us being able to feel safe in our world, they're not really able to develop. And so, people continue these sort of chaotic behaviors throughout their life, and whatever that looks like, it's very different. I use crime and drug families as an example. So expecting someone to have a level of confidence that I would have as somebody who, does feel safe in the world and has the means to have an education and, can take care of myself, like expecting, these people to have that kind of healthy self-confidence is kind of crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And so how are they going to go back out into the world if your life has gotten to the point? And again, I speak in generality, so let's be really clear. There are people who do just happen to find themselves in the wrong place at the wrong time, or they make one mistake. They have one glass of wine too many. They drive home. Something bad happens. The rest of their life may be fine, mm-hmm. But they do make that one mistake. I'm talking about the people who their lives are in such chaos that they've ended up in prison.
Mm-hmm.
So expecting those folks to come into prison, spend time with more people who have had the same similar kinds of things, and then leave and be able to somehow function well in society is kind of ludicrous. Mm-hmm. And so, we do try to help.
Well, what do you teach? What do you do? How do you do it?
So it's a complicated question. The only reason I'm not hesitating, it's just there are many different things that we do. One of the main things that I do that's basically the vehicle for the other things that I carry is really working with them to learn how to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And that learning how to learn, the skills that we work on there, which is you can use their academics as a very clear example of that, then translates into learning how to learn how to take care of themselves, learning how to learn how to set boundaries, you know, holding them accountable for their behavior. But really, the thing that keeps coming to my mind is that monitoring behavior, monitoring everything that they do and every little thing that they do right,
mm-hmm.
lots of praise,
mm-hmm.
lots and lots of praise.
Well, you know what I like? When we were getting ready for this interview, Marie, you were talking about all of us have things going on, and all of us, you know, like the work-life balance, you talked about that and how we put all this pressure on ourselves to be a certain way in the world, and how you like the idea of practical application, because we often whip ourselves into this practice and it often doesn't serve us. So can you talk a little bit more about how you've laid that piece out?
So one example of this would be helping people understand about setting reasonable expectations.
Mm-hmm.
So I have, you know, students come in and they're immediately, oh, I'm going to get A's on everything. I'm going to this and that and that, da, 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 da. And they have this idea of what it means to be successful in a program. So you can take that idea and translate it out into anything that people do in their lives. This idea of what does it mean to be successful?
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, I'm going to accomplish whatever the pinnacle of that thing is. If mm-hmm. it's my job, then I'm going to be the person who has the most critical projects on their plate at any particular given moment. I am going to be the person that nobody can live without. If it's school, I'm getting straight A's in every class on every assignment, da 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 da. If I'm a mom or a dad, it's my kids participate in everything. They are outstanding and excellent. They get top grades, blah, 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 blah. The list goes on and on. You can make up whatever thing you want.
Mm-hmm.
So these women come in with the same kind of wrong thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have to do is most of the time it requires, you know, it requires failure,
mm-hmm.
like some significant failure to start with before they start to realize that it isn't about getting an A. It isn't about that. It's about giving your best effort. And sometimes a best effort is a B.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a best effort is a C. Sometimes a best effort is retaking your exam and learning what you need in order to be able to study well and prepare well. And so the difference between someone that has come to prison with that mentality and you and I sitting here with that mentality is that a lot of the people I deal with, their only way of coping with that sense of failure is to totally act out, to either turn to drugs, which then will a lot of times take them off into criminal behavior. Maybe they beat their kids. Maybe they did something terrible to another. I mean, all these sort of really dysfunctional activities.
Mm-hmm.
You and I might do something as dysfunctional, but smaller in scale. So mm-hmm. we might go home and lay around and eat Twinkies for 3 days.
Right.
But it's the same thing. It's the same unreasonable level of expectation that we set for ourselves. It's the same sort of dysfunctional response to not achieving, and that was in air quotes, not achieving this whatever thing that we thought was so awesome. And we just, we beat ourselves down. We beat ourselves down, and it's really sad.
Yeah.
It's a sad thing.
I love the example, and maybe we're going a little too far ahead, but I want to throw it in here. The example that you gave when you were talking about how you were working with some your students, and the example that you gave around choosing, for instance, not to communicate and hang out with people that you know are not good for you, and then, you know, the things that happen as a result of that. Share that with us.
So It is well known, and I'm going to talk about just general corrections for a moment. It is well known that one of the number one reasons that people reoffend is their associates.
Mm-hmm.
And I found a little saying that I made copies of and put up at all my students' on their desks that says, you are basically the sum of the five people that you spend the most time around. Mm-hmm. So if those people are not helping you be your absolute best self, then why are you spending time around them? Mm-hmm. And that is 100% true for every human being living on this planet. That is absolutely true. If you look around and the people that you spend the most time with mm-hmm. are people who are gossiping, people who are nagging, people who are always looking at the, you know, sad things, or they're always complaining about the state of the world, or they're always complaining about something that's not going on in their life. If they're people who are angry all the time, if they're people who are constantly criticizing you or asking you why you're not doing more, mm-hmm. all of those things, if those are the people you're spending time around, it's not a surprise that you're miserable. And in a corrections environment, it is even more critical that these women learn that they need to value themselves enough to spend time around people who are going to help them be their best selves and not who are going to make them feel worse about themselves. Now, the caveat to that is it is so difficult to recognize when you are around people like that. And if you can recognize it, to extricate yourself from those relationships, because as women, we live in relationship, we value our relationships, mm-hmm. and it is incredibly, excruciatingly difficult mm-hmm. to disentangle ourselves. Even how many people listening to this show, everybody should be raising their hands, has been in a relationship with someone they know is yes. toxic, mm-hmm. and they cannot bring themselves, for whatever reason, to disengage from it. So everybody listening to the show better have a hand up in the air,
right?
Because
right.
my hand is in the air, and so is Della's. And this is what's happening. So this isn't just one person with these women. Sometimes it can be everybody they know.
Sure, sure.
And so we work a lot on how do you identify those relationships, and then what do you do with them?
You are listening to KBOO Bread and Roses on 90.7 FM on your dial. Marie, this is what you're talking about is so on point, and I really appreciate how you are absolutely sharing this with us in a way that it relates to people that are in prison, in corrections, and that we all have the same things going on at a different level, but they're happening. I love what you said when we were getting ready for this interview. You talked about how you hold your students accountable using that example of associating with people that are toxic.
Well, as we all know, relationships are tricky little buggers.
Mm-hmm.
We all know this. It is very difficult, even under the best of circumstances, to make sure that our relationships are healthy and that they are helping us be better people. Like, they're helping bring out the beauty in us, and they're not making us feel small and making us feel bad. And that is even more difficult in a prison environment where the only people, well, other than people that you write to or people that you talk to or whatever, I'm not including those folks because they're not your daily living companions.
Mm-hmm.
So in a prison environment, so let me just clarify real quickly. I work on the minimum facility. The mm-hmm. minimum and the medium are co-located. The minimum facility is a dorm environment. So mm-hmm. there are four dorms. There are between 120 and 130 women living in those dorms together at all times. And let me tell you, if you've never thought about it, that's the number one reason never to go to prison, is that mm-hmm. you have to spend 24 hours a day in a dorm with 120 to 130 other women, all of them with varying degrees of just problems, problematic behavior, et cetera, et cetera. So when all you have available to you is other people who are in that environment and potentially who have had the same kinds of problems that you have, mm-hmm. it's very difficult to try to even practice having healthy relationships
mm-hmm.
because you haven't seen them in your life, more than likely. People who are in there are probably not much different than you are. Although a lot of times when people get into a program or they get into treatment or whatever, they do start to change and grow. But that number of people is very small. And a lot of times they're trying to only stay around people who are doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. So they don't want all these other people who are still sort of hanging, you know, not doing anything good for themselves. So it gets very complicated. And because I don't live in the dorm with them, I have to listen to what they're saying, and I have to rely a lot on my own intuition and really focus on what I hear them saying and focus on their responsibility. So one of the tools that I use, like, we look at thinking patterns a lot. We look at, you know, some of the problems that people generally have, some thinking errors, harmful thinking patterns. And let me be really clear. We all have these all the time in greater and lesser degree. And some people will have like one or two of them. Some people might have a lot of them. We all have them.
Give us some examples.
So some examples of harmful thinking patterns that I see a lot are the I can't syndrome, which is often an escape for accountability. Well, I can't do that. I can't not talk to that person. Another one is a lack of empathy. And this usually comes, if you're not a sociopath or a psychopath, that, because that's a, I mean, that's kind of the definition, is like they're not able to feel empathy. I'm not talking about those people. That's a mental health issue. But people who come up or who grow up in families where, you know, they're abused or they're neglected, they don't learn how to feel that. So it's very difficult for them. It's not impossible. It's just a difficult thing to learn, lack of empathy. The victim stance, which is where you blame others for your circumstances. And that gets bandied about quite a lot. And people will accuse each other of being victims. I don't know if anybody listening to this has ever done this, said, well, you're just playing the victim. You're just playing the victim. And, you know, instead of saying, well, what is your role in whatever that is? What is my role? When something's not going right, I had over the last 5 years, I had a number of, I had several friendships that abruptly ended. And I was totally taken aback, and I was very angry for a while. And then at some point I was like, well, the one thing all those things had in common was me. That was me. Like, they all had that in common. I was the common denominator. And so then I went to that whole thing of like, I'm terrible. I'm a terrible person. Oh, blah, blah, blah. So then I went down the victim stance. You know, instead of saying what was my role, I totally went into sort of victim mode of like, well, they were all talking about me. Why didn't they care? Why didn't they blah, blah, blah? Why didn't they come to me? And it's only been recently that I've been able to look at that and say, well, it's entirely possible that they had a point and that they didn't think they could approach me, whatever, whatever that was. So that whole idea of, you know, the victim plays in. And then I'll mention one other one. And this is an interesting one, because I think this happens and people don't recognize it, but it's called fragmented thinking. It's where you think one way one minute and then the opposite way another minute.
Give us an example.
It's when you sort of change your opinion or your thought on something depending on who's around.
Gotcha.
And I consider that to be fragmented thinking. So I give them assignments. You know, they have to do journal assignments and whatnot. And I'll ask them, they have a workbook in the 7 habits. So they will do some survey in the workbook and they'll answer one way, usually a lot of times in the surveys, of course, they know what they want to be. So they'll answer what they want to be and not what they are, because they don't know how to reflect. And that is also a function of higher development and higher thinking, is being able to reflect on our lives and get an accurate sense. And not just what we want ourselves to be, but to be able to look at ourselves honestly and accurately and say, oh, here's some good stuff and here's some stuff I need to work on.
Right.
And so that level of reflection doesn't exist when I start with them, and it gets there.
Okay.
So you'll see something there where they'll say, there'll be a question like, on a scale of 1 to 5, how do you rate yourself in terms of problem solving? And they'll be like, oh, I'm a great problem solver, 4, you know, whatever. And then there'll be an actual sort of short answer question that will ask them something about problem solving. And they'll leave it blank because they have no idea what it means.
Right.
And so that's fragmented thinking, when people, they don't even really understand what problem solving means, but they know that they want to be good at that.
Right.
And so then when they have to come over and talk about what it means to be a good problem solver or something like that, they don't even really know how to answer. And so to me, that's showing that they don't really connect these two questions as being about the same thing.
Right. We, again, are going to go to break. You are listening to Bread and Roses, KBOO FM. We'll be right back.
Turn off the radio. We have no place to go. More important than near. Inside the sheets, we are. Or to fear, and all of those other unpleasant things in the world which fill us with dread. They're nothing compared to our loving, our sweet loving. So let's stay in felt like this. One night I cannot miss being with you. I sleep so easily when you encircle me.
We're back. You are listening to Bread and Roses on KBOO. I'm your host, Della Ray. That was another number from Belinda Underwood, local artist. The CD is called Look to the Skies. And the actual artwork on the CD is simply beautiful. So thank you, Belinda, for providing that music for us this evening. We are discussing practical application of self-care. Marie Daniels is in the studio, and we're talking about self-care as it relates to women that are incarcerated. But I just applaud you, Marie, because you're doing such a great job of also reflecting back to us as people. And true enough, women are incarcerated. We get that. But we all make mistakes. So tell us more about that.
Well, I think it's important to realize that these people are incarcerated for things that some people do to a greater and lesser degree and just don't get caught. Mm-hmm. And so being in prison doesn't mean that you're a bad person or anything like that. These women, and I'm assuming the men also, but the women, the patterns, the habits, the thinking patterns, the behavior patterns, the dysfunctional relationship issues, the lack of coping skills, those are all things that all of us suffer from to greater and lesser degrees. Mm-hmm. And if we found ourselves in a prison environment, it's easy enough to sit out here and say, well, I would know better than that. No, like it isn't like that. And so, you know, one of the things that if you are not an incarcerated person and you have access to doing things to take care of yourself, it's really important that you do that. It's really important that you pay attention to how you make decisions. It's important that you pay attention to who the people around you are and what they reflect back to you. It's really important that you develop the capacity to reflect on your behavior and or your choices and the consequences or the results of your decisions. Those things are all really important.
They are. And you know, one thing my mom always said to us, well, you are the company you keep. You are the company. She always says that. And just kind of going back to the practical application of when you're talking to your students, you gave an example of choosing to be around toxic people. Walk us through the practical application of that.
I think that there's so many layers to this. There's so many different perspectives you can take on it. Some of it is, what are your habits around self-care? You know, are your habit, do you have a habit of just saying yes to everybody? Mm-hmm. Do you have a habit of saying no to everybody just out of defensiveness and, you know, meanness? Do you have a habit of sort of hanging around people who gossip because you just want them to like you, or for whatever reasons, like mm-hmm. the reasons why we make these decisions are infinite. Mm-hmm. But we all have that little voice inside of us, or many people have that little voice inside of us that lets us know that this isn't really healthy for us. So when you're hanging around and so-and-so is talking about somebody else, why are we standing there listening to that? Mm-hmm. Why do we do that? And that's a question everybody has to answer that for themselves. Like, why do I listen to those things? Maybe you don't know how to extricate yourself from those conversations. So, you know, staying in these toxic relationships, I mean, women live in relationship, women live for relationship. And I think that when women get to a certain point, we all get kind of desperate for any kind of relationship because it's almost impossible for us to live outside of it.
You gave me the example of talking to your students in particular about hanging out with people that are toxic, and then you hold them accountable. How do you do that?
So the reason I'm having some trouble answering mm-hmm. this question is that it's kind of on a case-by-case basis. It kind of depends on what's happening. So mm-hmm. sometimes I will hear information from other students. Sometimes I will hear information from my clerks. Sometimes they will get some sort of disciplinary action. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll hear they'll say one little thing and I'll pick it up mm-hmm. and I'll know exactly what that is. So some of it is very context dependent. But if I find, for example, in the prison culture, there's a whole thing about pen pals mm-hmm. where, you know, you write people, and with women especially, it's, you know, you want to write people and get them to put money on your books mm-hmm. and all this sort of thing. So if I find out that my students have all these pen pals, I'll just ask them and I'll say, you know, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. Are you planning on marrying that person? Mm-hmm. How many other people are you planning on marrying? Like, is that an ethical thing? Is that behavior that's going to get you where you want to go? Mm-hmm. Is that the life you want to live? Is that the person that you want to be? And so that's a very sort of prison specific example, but that is an accountability. Mm-hmm. Like, you tell me that you want to do something different with your life, and yet you're deceiving people and you're trying to fleece money out of them. Mm-hmm. That's not what an ethical person does. That's mm-hmm. not what a person with integrity does. And so there are various ways that they can be held accountable for that. If I have a student who comes in and says, oh, I got in trouble for such and such, then I really pay attention to how they deliver that news. Were they mocking the security staff that they talked to, you know, or did they come in and say, I made a bad decision mm-hmm. and I got into trouble? And then it's about, if they come in and they're immediately sort of acting with attitude, I'm like, okay, well, is this the person that you want to be? That you come walking in here and talking like you're being really disrespectful and really rude right now. Mm-hmm. What does it say about you? Mm-hmm. You know, you're not taking accountability for your part in this. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter how small it is or how dumb you think it is or whatever. Your job as a person, a professional person, and as a mature adult person is to say, okay, I did something and maybe I don't agree with it, but I got to I got some sort of consequence for that. So I'm going to try to do better next time.
That's very practical. There's a quote I want to share with you from Barbara DeAngelis, and it says, living with integrity means not settling for less than what you know you deserve in your relationships, asking for what you want and need from others, speaking your truth, even though it might create conflict or tension, behaving in ways that are in harmony with your personal values, making choices based on what you believe, not what others believe.
So I think that's interesting, and I think that that's definitely a statement that there are so many assumptions mm-hmm. in that definition of integrity, mm-hmm. assumptions that people understand what values and beliefs are, mm-hmm. assumptions about knowing what you need, assumptions mm-hmm. about knowing what you deserve in a relationship. What is your truth? Mm-hmm. I mean, when we start talking about, so one of the things we do in the morning is we do a check-in where I go around the room and I say, how are you feeling? Mm-hmm. I have to give them lists of feeling words. Mm-hmm. and I have to make some words off limits. Mm-hmm. And this happened for probably the first 3 months of class. They have to use the lists because they don't even have any words that they can describe their emotional state. Mm-hmm. And so I would encourage, as a practical application of self-care, is increase your emotional vocabulary. Mm-hmm. And but in order to even have that be useful, you have to check in with yourself emotionally, and you have to be able to take a word and put it on that emotion. And most of us are so emotionally not educated that it's very difficult to expand your emotional vocabulary beyond I feel good or I feel sad. Mm-hmm. And if for women especially, like, we are very complicated. We have and I think men do also. I'm a woman, so I speak as a woman. Mm-hmm. Emotions can get very nuanced. Mm-hmm. And so being able to really check in with yourself and do that educational piece about, well, how am I feeling? Maybe I need to have a list in front of me for a while. Mm-hmm. And pick the words, like, try to associate how I feel with certain words. I mean, that's a really good tool for most of us to have in our relationship toolbox. The idea of understanding values and beliefs. I mean, we did mission statements. Mm-hmm. And everybody should have a mission statement.
Yes, for sure.
Everyone should have a mission statement. You should know what your fundamental values are. You mm-hmm. should know what you believe about them. Mm-hmm. That is really important. You should know the kind of person that you want to be. Mm-hmm. And then if you know, so for example, I have women who say, I want to be the best parent I can be. And then they come in and tell me that they got caught doing something wrong. And so my question is, when you went to do that, did you ask yourself, is this going to help me be the best parent I can mm-hmm. be? No. Did you think about, would I do this if I had to explain this to my child? No, you didn't. Mm-hmm. So you're not acting in integrity with what you say you want. So it's all a learning opportunity. It's not about shaming them, but it's about really calling out this whole idea of, like, well, you tell me this, but then you go out and act a different way. My definition of integrity is how you act when nobody's watching. Mm-hmm. And that's it. Like, that's the bottom line for me. That is my integrity, is how I act when nobody can see me. Am I going to pick up that piece of litter when there's nobody watching mm-hmm. me? Maybe I will, maybe I won't. It depends on how bad it's raining.
Right.
But that's my definition of integrity. So this is part of this whole practical application. And it's, again, like, if you think about Maslow's hierarchy, I mean, you could probably apply it to your physical state, your mental state, and your emotional state all independently. And you could say, all right, well, mentally and physically, I feel like I'm kind of high up the pyramid, but wow, emotionally, I might need more work. Mm-hmm. You know, I might need to really kind of boost my emotional intelligence a little bit. Just because you're not in prison doesn't mean that you're, you know, an emotional guru.
Right.
Doesn't mean that any of us are emotional gurus, but it certainly is. Having more emotional intelligence, I think, is a big step towards people learning more about being confident in themselves, mm-hmm. understanding how they feel, understand why they're feeling that way, and then being able to act appropriately mm-hmm. based on feelings. You can get as angry as you want to get. Be angry. That's fine. Whatever. What you don't want to do is act out of that anger. Mm-hmm. So if you find yourself in that, we know what that escalated state is. We all know it. Palms are sweating. Face is hot.
Yes.
Heart's beating. Adrenaline is just, like, flowing. You could spit adrenaline like acid across the table at the person. And that's all fine. But what isn't okay, where it really starts to disintegrate, is when you start talking, mm-hmm. when you're feeling like that, mm-hmm. or yelling, mm-hmm. or acting. Mm-hmm. Because when you're, that's your lizard brain, that's your primal fight or flight mechanism that's engaged there. When that part of your brain is engaged, your higher thinking, your frontal lobe, is deactivated.
Yes.
It is physiologically impossible for you to access your higher thought. So another example of a practical application for self-care is when you are highly escalated, and don't lie and say you don't know what it is, because we all know what that is, then you need to learn how to, literally, that whole count to 10. Mm-hmm. It is okay for you to stand up and walk away mm-hmm. for 10 seconds. Mm-hmm. It is okay for you to say, I am really angry right now and I need to take 5 minutes and I need to go walk it off.
Right.
That is absolutely appropriate.
Yeah, it sure is. Have you heard of, I'm not sure if it's a book or a thought about the 10-10-10 before you do something. How is this going to affect your life for the next 10 seconds, the next 10 minutes, the next 10 years? You know, and even if you can get to the 10 seconds, I think it's great. Because sometimes I can't even get to the 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And so one other piece, you know, we're of course always running out of time and there's so much more I want to cover with you, but there's two things I really want to get out with our listening audience. And one of them is, you were talking about giving your power away and then getting mad because you've given your power away. Talk on that.
Well, I think, and this is something that I see in women a lot, is that they will go along with something and then they get mad. They get angry about whatever the result is. Mm-hmm. And at that point, it's resentment, whatever, whether it's in your intimate relationships, whether it's in getting sucked into doing PTA stuff. You basically, it's a combination of not setting boundaries and not wanting to say no and giving away your power. And I think bottom line, everybody has the power to say no. That's either no, I don't want to do that. No, that's not okay with me, whatever. Now, given there are circumstances where saying no is not honored and there's violence involved or whatever, this is not what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about is those times where we make the decision, because it is a decision to not say no. Mm-hmm. It's a decision to accept more responsibility and to have more expected from us when we didn't really want to do it. And that's all giving away our power, even though you think, oh, well, everybody needs me and everybody comes to me and right. I'm the center of attention, da 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 da. That's not about power.
Right.
It's not, it just isn't about power.
And self-esteem and valuing ourselves, practical application.
There is so much that's said and written about this, it's impossible to add anything really meaningful to it. I think that you have to take all the victories all the time. It doesn't matter how little it is. It doesn't matter how little it is. If your victory is that you get up in the morning and you make a cup of coffee and yes. you get your kids out the door and they got all their food and they have a reasonable amount of clothes on and they get out the door on time, just take that as a victory.
Absolutely.
Any little thing. I mean, I have when people, I will literally have, if I have people who have to take a test twice mm-hmm. and in the second time they answer a question more fully mm-hmm. than the first time, we take it as a victory. I don't care that they had to do it twice.
Right.
They learned and they remembered and they moved forward. So even little things like that, mm-hmm. if they remember one day to use, they use a good feeling word one day.
Yes.
Or they acknowledge it, then that's a victory. You have to take all of the victories all of the time. It doesn't mean you have to throw yourself, you know, a confetti glitter bomb party every time.
Right.
But you should... You beat yourself up enough over every little ridiculous thing that you think you didn't do right. Why wouldn't you give yourself some praise for all the little things that we do right?
Absolutely. And you know, Marie, that's a whole nother show. And I believe, and the reason why I'm so into this work and advocacy around self-care, I think that's the number one character flaw, or maybe I shouldn't say character flaw, but the number one thing women suffer from is lack of self-esteem and valuing ourselves. And we could be here all night, all day. And I do not believe now or ever is that subject exhausted. I just don't believe it. Because you look around and like what we're talking about now, it is so, there's so much truth to it. And I also believe you're talking about taking the victories, just being thankful. Be glad that you even have a cup of coffee to have in the morning. And I think that's a huge piece. What do you say about that?
Well, given this where I work, I would say that I do have an enormous amount of gratitude for the things that I have. When you're talking about you can't even share a meal with someone, mm-hmm. it's against policy, and understandably so, then I feel like I have a lot to be grateful for that I would not have thought about before.
Well, I'm grateful for this show. Marie, thank you. And, you know, it's time. Can you believe it goes by so fast? We really need to wrap up here. Our collective brings you this show every Friday night at 6 p.m. and women have had this forum on KBOO for 35 years. This airspace is here to be shared. This collective, Bread and Roses, is open to new members. If you are interested, please contact KBOO's volunteer coordinator, Ani Haynes. You can also find us on KBOO's website, kboo.fm/breadandroses. I do want to make an announcement really quickly to correct a web link that went out earlier. And if you are interested in the Oregon Women Veterans Conference, please visit OregonWomenVeteran.com. This conference is happening in Eugene, March 28th and 29th. But again, you do need to go to the website, OregonWomenVeteran.com. So we want to thank our guest, Marie Daniels, our engineer, Leanne Kruntz, and specifically to you, our listeners and supporters of KBOO. We would not be here without you. And I do want to say, dear community, now is the time to take the very best care of ourselves, all of the time and everywhere we go. No exceptions. Thank you for joining us and be well.
The time is 7:04. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, Hard Knock Radio.
At the dawn of the day, all the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses. Marching, so many women dead. We cry through our city, their ancient call for bread. Our stomachs are empty.